The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation for the world-famous Second City Theater. This is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and in your life. Yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It operates at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and navigating change. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
Our guest today on Getting the SAN is Frederica Fabricius. Frederica is a leading expert in the field of neuro-leadership. As an executive coach and leadership specialist, she has extensive expertise working with top executives from Fortune 500 companies. She is the co-author of The Leading Brain, Powerful Science-Based Strategies for Achieving Peak Performance. After starting at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research and then continuing as a management consultant at McKinsey, Frederica now applies her unique expertise in leadership consulting, where she has empowered countless clients to reach their full potential and deliver peak performance at critical moments. Frederica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So you wrote an article in April titled Finding Your Environmental Set Point. And that made the point that best business people are really just like the best athletes. And when you realize the incredible importance of kind of just routine plays. So you wrote, quote, "What makes those easy catches look easy is the fact that professional athletes know exactly where they need to be in order to perform at their best. They're experts not because they can run faster or leap higher, but because they have an ability to put themselves in precisely the right spot." How do business people find their environmental set point?
That's a very good question. For me, that is all about understanding your mix of neurochemicals. So some people, for example, they have a very active dopamine system, so they constantly need new challenges. They love work environments where you have to travel, where there's always new deadlines, where things get changed around on a daily basis, while other people have a more active serotonin system, and they will prefer to work in an environment with more routine, with more of a structure, maybe at not such a fast pace. But here's the catch. It's not that the high in dopamine people are the smart, high performers and the serotonin people are the, you know, the boring, slow ones. It's just a matter of what kind of environment you need to perform. So there's no difference in intelligence. It's just that people have different preferences, what kind of environment they enjoy and where they are most productive. And you can find this by taking the NeuroColor personality test or the state rate anxiety test. There's several tests out there, even freely available, that you can take that will help you determine your set point.
So this is fascinating because I think, you know, in the past, people have talked about introverts and extroverts. And I think what you're doing is sort of digging more into what is the science at play here, because it maybe isn't that simple. And so you talk about the DNA of peak performance. And I think we should go through a little bit of the science because I think it's important. And you start with dopamine. And I love that you said a journalist called that the Kim Kardashian, a journalist called it the Kim Kardashian of neurotransmitters. How does that work?
It's so fun. Mm-hmm. Well, dopamine is a substance. It's released when you're having fun, when you do new things, when you're curious, when you are out and on adventures. Artistic people have a lot of dopamine, and also people who are just entrepreneurs and always curious for new things. I'm sure that the actors in your theater have a lot of dopamine. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so mentally flexible.
Yeah,
dopamine makes us very flexible, and it makes us enjoy life. So it's the first of the DNA in peak performance, but I sometimes call this framework fun, fear, and focus. Mm-hmm. So dopamine gives us the fun.
All right,
we have fun at work, our prefrontal cortex works better.
And then what gives us the fear?
The fear that is not about having an awful boss or, you know, spending your life in anxiety. This is about just being slightly over-challenged. putting yourself just slightly out of the comfort zone. I find that very important because some people, they stay in the same job for 20 years and they do the same things every day. And people think they're fabulous at what they are doing, but deep inside they are bored and they are not performing at their best. They are bored out. And I think we all need to challenge ourselves to take on projects that are a little bit too big. Not so that they overwhelm us, but so that they excite us.
And is that what releases noradrenaline?
Yes. I sometimes call it the nicer little brother of cortisol. Hmm. Many people have heard of cortisol. It's a stress hormone that actually damages your brain. So when you're on a long-term stress, you have very high cortisol level, and it's not good for your brain. But under short-term stress, when you have to rise to the occasion, that's when noradrenaline is released, and it's actually good for your brain.
Okay, so we've got dopamine, we've got noradrenaline, and the third, and let's see if I can pronounce it, acetylcholine?
Acetylcholine. It's a substance that helps you to focus. And in order to perform well, it's so important that you're fully focused. And if you look at today's business world, most people are on their cell phones, constantly checking emails, constantly interrupted. And I think it's very important to have time where you can actually think and concentrate and focus. I'm sure that the actors on your stage don't check their cell phones while they are there. Maybe they might do it on some, you know, on purpose. While they are working, they're fully there, fully focused on the other people on stage, fully focused on the people in the audience, and that's why they are so good. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be if they were constantly distracted by other things.
Yeah, isn't that interesting that, you know, you think about this, it's like no one would ever think that a member of a symphony or a soccer team or an actor would be checking their phone while they're working. That would be insane, and yet the rest of the working world is constantly doing just that.
Yes. And, you know, I have four small children and they are always so focused. You can see acetylcholine at work. When they do something, they're fully there. They're not thinking of tomorrow. They're not thinking of yesterday's mistake, and they are so happy. And I think even adults can reach that. They just need to learn to not multitask so much. And to, I think it's a skill that people lose, but that you can regain just by, you know, practicing focus.
Now, you also mentioned that inside this sort of trio might explain why some individuals feel the need to manufacture emergencies, which is something like we all know that person. We've all worked with that person.
Yeah.
What is it? What's going on there that they have to, like, you know, be a crazy maker?
Oh, that has to do with our dopamine system. These people very often have a mutation in their dopamine receptors, the DRD4 receptor, for those who are curious. And in science, they're called sensation seekers or even dopamine junkies. They constantly need something new going on or they get bored. So they change projects. They might at last minute mess everything around so that they can fully focus because they need more stress in order to perform at their best. While for other people, they might need less stress to perform at their best. People are very different how they respond to stress.
Mm-hmm. So then that, all right, so that and that goes back to your point, which is like the most important thing then is being self-aware to figure out, okay, how does your brain work? And then finding a location that supports how your brain works.
Yes, I always tell, you know, I often have coaches and people approaching me, asking me, can you help me? I'm so stressed out. Do you have some meditation techniques, emotional regulation? Should I work out? Should I meditate? And I say, you know, you can do all of that and it's good for you. But first of all, we need to take a look at your predisposition and at your environment and whether you have a good situation there. And if you don't, we need to change the environment and not you. Most people think they have to change when they're stressed, when in reality, they should shape their environments. Yeah. And that's much more effective.
Mm-hmm. All right, you tell a story in the book, and I'm a big soccer fan, and I remember this completely because I was watching the game in the 2006 World Cup. So it was France and Italy, and the score was tied, and France had this legendary soccer player, Zinedine Zidane, who actually had a fantastic reputation, like a good guy. But he lost it during the match, headbutted a player on the Italian squad. He got a red card. France ends up losing the World Cup. And use this as a great story for, you know, what is going on in the brain when someone just loses it like that?
That is, you know, I think it's something we all have been there. What happens is that our amygdala, which is the center for processing negative emotions, gets very active. And a lot of cortisol is released. And when that happens and we get into what is called a threat state, our prefrontal cortex for rational analytical thinking shuts down. So what happens is that rather than thinking logically and rationally, we just go back to a threat state. And when people are in a threat state, there's fight, flight, or freeze.
Mm-hmm. So that, and that's what he did. And what's interesting about that is if you know, we're predisposed towards that condition, right? You write, quote, "We spend a lot more of our time on Earth running from danger than running from the bus." So even though we're in this modern context, we are really still like there's this caveman brain of ours that hasn't changed.
Absolutely. And I think it's a good thing. It makes us survive. If we didn't have that negativity bias of processing negative information 9 times more strongly than positive information, we wouldn't be here today. So don't blame it, embrace it. Hmm. You know, it's good to know about this. And when it happens to you, then you just know what just happened. And very often this already calms you down. There's a technique in the book that is called emotional labeling. Mm-hmm. And what you do, it's not developed by us, but we mention it. And what you do is you take a moment and you just name what's going on. So you can say, I'm upset, I'm stressed, I'm sad, I'm nervous, mm-hmm. I'm hungry, whatever is worrying you at the moment. And it helps you to calm down your overactive amygdala. Just doing that in the brain scanner shows that you increase prefrontal cortex activation and you decrease your amygdala activation.
So this is a theme in the book that I think is worth mentioning, which is you do offer a lot of solutions, a lot of ideas for things people can do, and invariably, almost always, they are small. They're small actions. And I want you to talk about that. Talk about what it is, because I think when we're talking about the human brain and changing behaviors, I think we assume that we need to make incredible big life changes. But you actually speak to the opposite of that, of no, you need to make sort of small changes.
Yes, small changes can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. And also, our brain is very susceptible. Mm-hmm. Is that how you say it?
Yes,
our brains are very susceptible to change. Mm-hmm. I say that again. So our brain hates change. Hmm. We are very much afraid of big changes. And what happens when you plan a huge goal that overwhelms you? You stick to that for maybe 1 week or two, and then you go back to where you've been before. And when you take small steps instead, that's something that Robert Maurer, who introduced that approach of the Kaizen small step in business, he said, when you take small steps, you tiptoe past your amygdala. So you don't alert your amygdala. Your brain doesn't even notice that you plan to change, and so you don't get so threatened by it.
All right. So can you help me stop biting my fingernails?
I hope so. That would be great.
All right. So I've done this. I'm a 50-year-old man, soon to be 51. I have bitten my nails as long as I can remember. Okay, so I want to focus in now, and I would like to change that behavior. What steps do I need to take to make this change?
Yeah, to me, it would be important to establish a schedule of reward and threat.
Okay.
So what you need to keep in mind is that you need to reward yourself for positive behavior, and you need to punish yourself for bad behavior in some way or the other. I mean, dog trainers know this, right? Okay. And from a brain perspective, it also makes sense. So what you could do, for example, is, I guess you have probably done all of that before, but it does make sense to put this awful, disgusting nail polish on that tastes really badly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this would punish your bad behavior. And then what most people fail to do is to reward themselves. They beat themselves up. What they do is they sit at their desk. They think, now I'd like to bite my nails, mm-hmm. right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they inhibit and suppress that urge for maybe 3 minutes, 5 minutes, and then they cave in.
Right.
And then they beat themselves up. That's just what usually happens. They try to use cognitive inhibition. And that is something that we know doesn't work, because our prefrontal cortex that we use for inhibition is not as strong as our limbic system, where reward and threat are processed. And when those two get into a fight, the prefrontal cortex always wins. So what should you do? You need to establish an alternative routine.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a cue, so a moment in which you like to bite your nails, let's say you're nervous or whatever it is in your case, and yep. then you have a routine, you bite your nails, and then you have a reward, your anxiety goes down, or you just enjoy the nail biting. It mm-hmm. gives you some kind of joy.
Yep.
What you need to do is, when most people do that, the moment comes, they suppress the unwanted behavior, and then after a while they do it anyhow. And this is a very depressive pattern.
Right.
And what you need to do is, you need to define an alternative routine that is fun.
Hmm.
Some people define an alternative routine, but they don't make it fun. They say, I won't bite my nails. Instead, I write emails to my mother-in-law, or something that they really don't enjoy.
Uh-huh.
It needs to be something positive. So what could you do that could be, it give you small bursts of dopamine and of joy in your everyday life?
Okay, so I've thought about this. I asked my wife about it. I'm like, when do I bite my nails? And she goes, you bite your nails when you are bored and you're not doing. Because I'm a very active person. Like, when I vacation, I'm immediately, like, I start doing stuff. And I like to do that.
Yeah.
So I've thought about this, and I was like, okay, so I could do the polish or whatever, to, you know, the bad tasting stuff, but what is my reward? And it's like, I almost thought it's like, oh, I get to watch a TED Talk, you know, or I get to be influenced by a piece of knowledge, because that's the stuff that I like to read. I like to, you know, hear about new ideas. So I was
mm-hmm.
I was thinking I would sort of queue up, you know, some conversations, whether it's a podcast or a TED Talk or an article or whatever, because I don't bite my nails when I'm, like, doing research.
That's a very good idea, and it's rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that is fun. Most people choose something even worse. You know,
yeah.
I won't bite my nails. Instead, I will clean my kitchen. And that is not very much fun, at least not to most people.
Right.
So you should, and what you could also consider is that each habit is a neuronal pathway that has been used a lot. So it's a little bit, I don't know if I can explain this well, but, you know, each behavior we have is a cascade of neurons that are connected to each other. And when you use them a lot, the connections between them go stronger, become
mm-hmm.
stronger.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you use that habit, the stronger it becomes. So what you need to do is, you need to, let's say you have the cue, you're bored, okay, you have nothing to do.
Yep.
Normally, you also, instead, you should take a moment and identify that urge. So you identify the cue, the trigger. You say, oh, okay, now is a moment where I'm bored and would like to bite my nails.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to distract yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So then you need to read a fun article, watch a TED Talk,
yeah.
or engage in something fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then you need to, as a third thing, make that last. It's still okay if you watch a TED Talk for 10 minutes and then start biting your nails.
Right.
If you, the next day, watch the TED Talk for 12 minutes and then bite your nails.
Mm-hmm.
By prolonging the alternative routine, you make it stronger.
Oh, okay. So don't like freak out if I go back to biting my nails. Just simply try to make that period longer. And by making it longer, the habit can change.
Yes, by making it longer, your habit grows more. By making it longer, your neuronal pathway is strengthened.
Interesting. So. All right. So I'm honestly, I already have, it's like a bet with an office mate, and we are going to try to do this. So I will report back.
That would be very interesting to hear. Yeah.
I want to also talk to you about the science of gratitude. We've been having this discussion around the office because a lot of improvisational workshops that we do with companies, we source out the need for people with their language and with their body language as well as their physical language, express gratitude to others as a foundation for better sort of collaboration. And you've got some science around this idea.
Yes, it is very powerful. People who do gratitude therapy or engage in gratitude actions every day, they have more energy, they are happier, they don't get sick as often. So it really is something that works. And if you think about it, in all religions all over the world, there is an element of gratitude. It's something that's very, very good for us. And that often in the modern world is forgotten because people want so much and don't appreciate what they have.
Yeah, and I think this is tied into the idea of sort of being healthy with our emotions. And you write, quote, "Our society places a regrettable premium on the ability to keep a stiff upper lip. Unfortunately, holding back your emotions not only doesn't work, it's also bad for you and for the people around you." So we are emotional beings, and what you're saying is you can't divorce your working day from that. You have to be able to use those emotions.
Yes, and in the business world, very often people think everything is rational. If you look at the economical theories, they are all based on the assumptions that you have the homo economicus, who makes rational decisions.
Right.
When you look at brain research, you will see that we are emotional creatures, right?
Yeah.
Emotions play a much bigger role in our brains than rational thinking. When you have emotional thinking and rational thinking, emotions always run the show. They are just stronger.
Right. So understanding that rather than hiding from it is key. And this also falls into, I think, another sort of myth, which is the myth of multitasking.
Oh, yes. It gives you 50% increase in mistakes. And I also think research shows that you take 50% more time to complete a task if you multitask. So these statistics speak for themselves. And when it comes to your brain, what you actually do is you don't multitask. You don't do two tasks at the same time. What you do is you switch back and forth between tasks rapidly. And this switch, not only does it take a lot of time, it makes you more prone to mistakes, and it takes up to 20 minutes to fully focus again. So from the moment you switch until you're fully immersed into your task again, it can take 20 minutes until you're fully focused again.
Wow. You talk about mindfulness, and there's a line that I often use when I'm doing my keynotes, which is I call improvisation loud group mindfulness, because you're usually improvising with a group of people, maybe, you know, 6 or 7 people, and you have to retain this incredible focus, but you're doing it while there's lots of ideas and language thrown out there. I was astounded by this because you said that there's actually science that shows that mindfulness actually changes your brain.
Yes, it's amazing. A lot of funds go just into mindfulness research these days because you can publish for sure because there's amazing results. So everybody does research on that. And what you can see is that in just 8 weeks, your prefrontal cortex gets thicker, so your rational thinking improves, your social emotional pathways get strengthened, so you improve your empathy. You also increase gray matter in your insula. The insula is a part of the brain that you need to improve your body awareness. And when you have a good body awareness, you also get a better intuition. And you don't get sick so quickly, because if you have a good body awareness, you will catch a cold early on. You know, you will know, oh, I'm about to get sick, or I'm very tired, I need to take a break. And you will be more aware of these very small warning signals in your life.
That's fascinating. I want to ask you, too, about this idea, and I think it's connected. You wrote, visualizing the path to your goal is more powerful than imagining its completion. So what is it about being in touch with process that is so important to our brain?
Wow, that's a good question. I do think it has to do with our basal ganglia. Mm-hmm. Our basal ganglia are the parts of our brain that are involved in procedural habits. So when you ride a bike, when you drive a car, things you do a lot, they happen in your basal ganglia. And it's a part of your brain that is usually unconscious. And you don't think about this stuff so much. So when you do take time to think about how you're going to do something, it activates or it brings processes to your consciousness that you usually process in your subconscious. Mm-hmm. And it gives you more choice on how to redirect your action. Because if you think about it, most of the day you are on autopilot.
Right.
You do things because you always do them. The way you get up in the morning, how you go to the office, whatever you do, most things are the same from day to day. We have routines. Mm-hmm. And when you think about how you do something, you can change these subconscious processes and actually create something new.
How is that connected to flow and this idea of flow?
I don't know if this is directly connected to flow, because when people get into flow when they have very high fear level.
Uh-huh.
So there's two things you need to get into flow. One is you need to have very high skill level. So only people who are very skilled in things get into flow. Mm-hmm. And then you need to be slightly over-challenged. And when you change your routines, this can for a while disrupt flow.
Mm.
Because, you know, if you have something and you have to start from scratch and do it differently, let's say you learned a certain way to play the piano and then you're retraining yourself to use your fingers differently for a while, you don't enjoy playing so much. But once you get to a higher skill level, you get more flow as a result.
Yeah, I was curious about that. I've always sort of wondered if flow could become something that is part of your everyday working habit, but maybe that's probably too much to ask of the brain.
Oh, but now I understand your question.
Yeah.
I do think that's absolutely possible. And some people, research shows that some people get into flow every day, while others never get to experience flow. Flow is not distributed equally among people.
All right, so who would be more susceptible to flow than others? What type?
It's very simple. People who are very highly skilled at what they're doing and who constantly challenge themselves. So people who work at a very high level of expertise. If your skills are mediocre and your challenge level is mediocre and you just kind of do the same stuff every day and you kind of enjoy it but not very much, you're not going to experience flow. But if you're always on the edge of expanding your skill level and expanding the challenges you embrace, then you can get into flow every day.
Well, okay, so that explains the people I work with, right? Because they are intensely trained young people who have to get up on a stage every night with no script.
Exactly.
Right. And so that's if the and I think that's the anything that we've seen sort of great ensembles work together, I think that it feels seamless. And what it is really is some level of group flow.
Absolutely. And it always depends on the skill level. You cannot experience flow if you don't have talent and skills.
Yep.
Unfortunately, and that's why we should all get better at things that we enjoy. And we should also keep in mind what talents we have. You know, if I tried to get into flow solving math problems, I would never succeed.
You and me both.
It's not just, it won't happen, right? I could practice a lot and I will reach a mediocre level, but I will never experience flow. So it's useless. Find something in life that you love and where normally we love things where we are talented. or how do I put this? You know, normally we enjoy tasks for which we have an innate talent. And then you can have a lot of flow in your life.
Yeah, and I do. And I like the second part of that too, which is then when you're there, make sure you're not just living comfortably inside that talent. Find ways to continually challenge yourself.
Absolutely. If you stay too long in the same job, other people might admire what you do. But when you feel that you're kind of bored with what you're doing, then you're on the wrong track.
Yep.
Then you need to make a change. Take on a task that is a bit too big for you and that will help you get back into flow. That's why, you know, many performing artists, they don't play the same songs over and over. I have a friend who went to a Bob Dylan concert and he was very disappointed because Bob Dylan didn't play the same old songs he's famous for, but some new ones.
Yep.
And the audience there felt a little bit cheated on. You know, they were like, oh, why isn't he playing the songs I came here to hear? But probably Bob Dylan would be very, very bored if he played them for the millionth time. So he did well in trying something new for himself.
Yep. This is all so fascinating. And of course, our half hour is coming to an end. But I do want to ask you before you go, if you have a yes and story. So we always end the podcast with this. The idea in improvisation is you can't get anywhere if you say no. And you can't just say yes. You have to say yes and. You have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a time in your life or work where you said yes and.
Yes, I have, and it really transformed my life. When I was back in neuroscience and working at the Max Planck Institute for Brain Research, I always wanted to be a researcher. I had this plan of becoming a professor and researching on the human mind and understanding how the brain works, and I never planned on doing anything else. And then at the time I lived in Frankfurt, and I went to a party, and it was called the Bankers and Brokers After Work. So, you know, Frankfurt is full of people who work in business. And I was just small talking, and then somebody there said to me, Fredrika, you would be just perfect to work for McKinsey. And I said, Mick, what? You know, who's that? What are you talking about? What is that? What are they doing? And I used to think that business is very boring. It's just about money, you know. You have to study business administration, and then you sit there in front of an Excel sheet and calculate. That was my impression before. So usually I would have said, no, I don't want to go and work in business. Mm-hmm. That's not for me. That's too materialistic. I don't want that. And instead I said, yes, let me see about that. And then I applied, and then I started there, and my life changed. You know, I wouldn't be able to do the job I do right now, consulting top leaders, if I hadn't worked in business. It has opened a new world for me. I wouldn't have found my husband, who also used to work for McKinsey. I wouldn't have met most of the people that surround me nowadays if I hadn't made that change.
So it sounds like, yeah, your yes and was challenging yourself to be a little uncomfortable in something.
Yes, and it was awful. I mean, the first day, I never studied business. I had no clue about these things. And then I would find myself in some project and they would say, Fredrika, tell us about our cost structure. How can we improve it? And I would just say, let me check that for you. You know, and this forced me to learn a lot of new skills. And this helps me also to realize what the leaders I'm working for are facing every day. I know how their life looks like. And I think I can only help people if they understand their reality.
Yep, that's a great yes and story. Fredrika Fabricius, the book is called The Leading Brain. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, about to slip down, working in a coal mine, going down, working in a coal mine, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my workday is over, too tired for having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down, working in a coal mine, about to slip down, working in a coal mine.
walking in a cold.